Welcome to In the Deep. I'm your host, Catherine Ingram. The following session was recorded on November 9th, 2025, in Victoria, Australia. It's called At the Feast. We have a weekend retreat and several more live sessions coming up in Victoria from November of 25 through March of 26. Check out the schedule at our website, catherineingram.com. Many people live with a list of desires. Maybe some of you can relate to that. Desires. Desires of objects, desires of experiences. And many people spend a life just running through the desires, right? Just chasing after that one, and maybe you get that one, maybe you don't. You go to the next on the list. But what happens when you get the desire, when you get the desired object or experience? Maybe then you have this moment of peace or contentment. Oh, finally, the chase is over. My teacher Poonjiji once said this amazing thing, which blazed into my awareness 30 years ago. He said, the satisfaction actually isn't in the object or the experience. It's in the cessation of the desire. You get a moment's rest from the madman or woman who's whipping you along. Go get that. Now go get that. Now go get that. And often we get the object or the experience. And, you know, it's nice initially. The new iPhone, the new car, a great meal, a trip somewhere. But is it fundamentally satisfying? We come back to a quiet, if we're lucky. We get the desire, we have the experience. And then you feel okay, you can rest a bit until the next desire. Is there a way to live where you're just content in being? Contentment is almost an old-fashioned word that you don't hear much about anymore. Contentment. It doesn't sell things if you're content. We're basically conditioned constantly to be hungry for more stuff. We live in materialistic cultures that want us to buy things and sell us the idea that that will make you happy, except that it's never ending, and we've seen it's been proven to us in our own experience and as we watch others. Some of the richest people in the world we can look at and see, they still keep going for more stuff until perhaps they see the emptiness of it eventually. So contentment. It's okay to just choose that. You can choose it. You can say, okay, this is enough, actually. Now, obviously, if you haven't had enough food, if you haven't had enough food, or you're thirsty for water, or any number of things that are physical demands, essentially, of course, then, it's great to fulfill it if you can. I'm talking about more the pictures in your head that say something out there is going to do it for you. And so can we reframe it? Can we say, not only am I full, but I'm at a feast at which I won't actually be able to experience everything at this feast. Like going to a fantastic wedding, there's a buffet table with everything you can imagine, fabulous food, a long, very long, several meters long. You can't even eat it all. You won't even be able to see all of it, right? And that's really our experience here. We forget. That's our experience, every one of us in this room. You're at a feast already. You can choose to fixate on what you think is missing and thereby be miserable, or you can say, wow, what a feast. Even just looking around at who's in the room, no doubt lots of people you would have an incredible connection with, because otherwise they wouldn't have come to an event like this. So, you know, kindred spirits all around. You won't have a chance really to talk to all of them, right? I often feel a slight pang of wistfulness when I think about the people who sit at the door and that they get to interact with each person. They get to look at each pair of eyes, you know, which is lovely. It's really up to each of us to choose wisely, to realize you've already won the big lottery. Here you are being against incredible odds that you wouldn't be. All of the things that had to go right throughout history. Not even just humans. That alone is a lot. That goes back a long way. Hundreds of thousands of years. For you, all the different times, in times when people died young, through much of history, through most of history, all of your ancestors had to make it to puberty, had to be healthy to keep passing it on, right? Had to weather wars and storms and famines and lucky thing to be born into this life. If we could really just see clearly a glimpse, really a true glimpse of the picture, we would just be struck in gratitude.
I just was interested to know how you relate to the word trust, because in life I've had many different mantras and many different things that I've sort of held on to that have guided me, but that seems to be what my life's now distilled down to, this one word, and
it's a good one. Yeah, there's this book of stanzas called The Verses on the Faith Mind, and it's all about trust. It's from the third Chan patriarch, sometimes called the third Zen patriarch. It's all about trust. So the way that I would interpret it is, the trust isn't in that you trust and things go your way. The trust is that you can go the way of how things are going. So that often means a lot of adjustments in one's life, of course, and that you get very flexible, right? You let go easily. You might have an agenda. People do. We have to sometimes, of course. But when you see your agenda is not going to happen, you let go. You trust that you are going to be figuring it out or just letting go. So you start to live much more in a flow. See, sometimes people in spiritual circles think, okay, I'm just going to get the code right on my understanding. Then things are going to really flow my way. Things are going to happen. I'm going to attract the angels who are going to be operating the play above or something. No. Would that it were so. You become easy about how things are going, even when they're not going your way. You might have an idea of how they should go, fair enough, but if they don't, okay also. And that is the trust that I would recommend. And more you get used to, like, when you really sink into this sense of just pure presence, just an awake animal, you're living a lot in your senses, you're operating in the world, most of us have to, right? And, you know, people can be disappointing. People can not do their part of things or even try to cheat you in ways, right? Things happen in life. Things happen in dealing with humans and also in every other thing, everything else. Where do we find any okayness with that, right? We can go to understanding. We can go to compassion. Those are easily accessible when you're in your right mind and heart, when you're quiet. Those are easily accessible then. You can just switch it. So that's where the trust is, that your own flow really is not demanding that the world conform to your wishes.
Hi.
Hi.
It might be similar to the trust question.
Mm-hmm.
Something I strongly believe in is manifesting, uh-huh. Manifestation. Mm-hmm. So just wanting, hopefully, your take a little bit on that. I know it's similar to the trust.
Well, if you're living in a kind of I want, and if only I can make my will or my story clear, it'll come to me. I'm not sure it really works. I think it sometimes works, but I don't think it's consistent. And for me, it can be kind of a gimme gimme, you know, like a state of desire. So it's a little bit contrary to what I'm speaking about in terms of contentment. I'm saying we're already full. We don't really have to manifest anything extra. If there's some particular thing that you're focused on, or is there, for instance? No. Okay. Right. Yeah, I mean, there have been different, over the years, there have been different scenes that were all about manifestation. For instance, The Secret was a big thing years ago. Similar to that, different kinds of things have been similar to that. It's not in the wheelhouse in which I have made experiments with truth. I've gone the other direction, right? Again, that the premise is we're full. And then everything else is extra, like, you know, it's an add-on. But I don't bother chasing it.
I'm keen to get your thoughts around karmic lessons and soul contracts.
About what?
Karmic lessons and soul contracts, and I suppose your thoughts around that and how to navigate, your thoughts on navigating that.
Karmic lessons and soul contracts. It's not how I think about things, soul contracts or karmic lessons. I used to believe in karma. It appealed to me a long time ago because I had an obsession with justice and injustice and karma, even the playing field. I would figure, okay, these good people who are having terrible experiences in this lifetime, they're going to get rewarded when the next life. And conversely, people who are misbehaving and awful are going to get their just due. It all was tidy, and I liked that. It appealed to me. I just found no evidence of it, and I kept looking. I tried because I liked it a lot. Yeah. And one night in India, in I think 1981 or two, do you know who Jack Kornfield is? He's a Buddhist teacher, old friend of mine. He and his wife and I were, we'd arrived into this place called Gaya, a real hellhole in India, and very dangerous place, terribly dangerous. And we'd come in at like midnight, and we wanted to get to Bodh Gaya, which is where the Buddha was allegedly enlightened. We were Buddhists. We wanted to go there. We were planning to study and do some retreats. And so we get into the train station, and as soon as we tell any of the taxi drivers that we are going to Bodh Gaya, they wouldn't take us, and we didn't know why. And they kept saying, dacoits, dacoits. And we didn't know what that meant, you know? Finally, this ancient man steps up. He's got a horse and carriage, like a cart, basically, a wooden cart. He steps up and he says, I'll take you. And he tells us some number, which was high, but we said, okay, sure. So he's got this really old horse, and we get into this cart, and now we're on our way to Bodh Gaya in the night. Now, the reason which we didn't know that no one would take us, and the meaning of the word dacoits is robbers. Robbers and probably murderers too. So that the road between Gaya and Bodh Gaya was very, very, very dangerous. But this old man with the broken down horse was very desperate, so he agreed. So we start out, and we're about 10 or 15 minutes out, and he's having to whip the horse to get the horse to move. He's having to really whip this poor horse. And we go further along, and now we're halfway there. So it's going to be the same if we turn around. And now he's really beating the horse. And we're just like frozen in the cart in the night. And I had a revelation in that moment that I could not justify this situation, that we were the proximate cause of this miserable suffering. We didn't intend it, you know. And I couldn't get us off the hook in a sense, and I couldn't tell a karma story that, oh, it's all karma. How do I know any of that? How does anyone really know that, right? We hear these things. They're nice fairy tales, but who knows if they're true? They may be. I just don't believe things without evidence anymore. And from that point on, it the whole belief fell away. And so with it, something like a soul contract as well, as though you've got a contract you made some other time in some other place with something called soul. So I live in a mystery. I do. I know much less now than I used to. Plus, my memory isn't as good. And that's very comfortable for me, frankly, not having to know, being surprised. Now and again, I like to say the mystery gives you a wink. You learn something, you have an aha moment. It's fun, right? You can't really hang your hat on it much. So all I'm ever doing in these contexts is I'm just giving my direct experience. And if it pings something in your direct experience, great. I don't expect that it should. I don't have any investment in anyone changing. I'm not really fit for any other job, so I keep doing this one. One of our Korean Zen teachers always talked about how don't know mind. Don't know mind. And then you're an eternal student. You learn. You observe and you learn easily because you don't have a big docket of things that it has to conform to or fit into.
Hello.
Hi.
Had a couple of questions just come through just then as you were speaking. The first one was when you mentioned you don't go after things. Mm. And I wondered about your connection to Source, if that was a reason, and what your experience of Source might be. And the second question was around your job and the importance that you might see for the work that you are doing for humanity, even though you also just said that you don't worry about any other any other thing outside of that.
Any results. Yeah.
Obviously, we all come from families and live in communities and experience our inner world and our outer world. And there's times that think there's a conflict, I guess, for me. And I return to Source in the, my own practices and with the people I feel safe to share that with. And then there's other experiences in my life where perhaps I have to be mindful of my judgment mind, but I'm sort of just curious about the important work on the planet right now and when you said that this is your work. So there's a few questions in there. I'm on a journey.
So I'll start with the experience of Source, as you put it. I keep it very simple. I would say I experience beingness as that taste. And it's super simple. We all have it already. We don't have to go looking for it. That's another misconception about the so-called spiritual path, that you have to go some distance somewhere, either inner or outer, to realize your true nature, when in fact you're swimming in it all. It's fundamentally what you are. And there are many glimpses through the day that are the exact, that exact experience. We overlook them and we often think it's supposed to be something grander. And sometimes it does shine more brightly, it's true, but we have many what you might call perfect moments, and I like to actually note them as such. Perfect moments, and you become more susceptible to them the more you notice them. And you notice how simple they are. You notice that it's just that you're walking along and it's a certain light and you just have this moment, or there's a bird twittering, or there's nothing even, you know. Or the first sip of your coffee or your tea or your green shake or whatever. All of those things, right? You lay down at night and it's just, it's throughout that we forget. You know, we forget. We think there's something else. It's going to make it more enhanced. In fact, it's all downstream. It's already here. So the other part about one's offerings to the world, the offerings are freely given. In this case, without expectation of results, that would put a pressure. Do you know the line, "The road to hell is paved with good intentions"? There's a lot of people with so-called good intentions who kind of muck things up a lot because ego gets involved. Like if I had an investment in people changing or having big revelations, I mean, sometimes it happens, right? It does happen. And that's very lovely. I'm happy about that, you know? But if I came in here and had that hope or expectation, I wouldn't even want to do this. Just like an archer, if an archer is overly fixed on the goal, there's a great Chung Tzu poem about this. He becomes blinded with his nervousness. You have to be in emptiness, really. And that's often the case with doing anything, whether it's great art or any kind of performance or just doing your job as an accountant, whatever it is, your clarity is more available to you when there's not a kind of fixation on how am I doing and is this important? Is this changing the world, for God's sake? You know, how long has that been attempted? and look at it. Chong Su also has a poem called When Life Was Full, They Made No History. And they lived and died like the seasons coming and going. The leaders were just higher branches on the tree, but not better or more important, right? They left no trace when they died. Yeah. It's very relaxing. Takes the pressure off. We go along, you know, we think we have to make some big mark, have some legacy. We're forgotten so quickly once we're out of here. We're forgotten very quickly. The people who loved us, we live in their hearts while they're alive. That is the legacy we get to leave. Yes, dear.
My question is about compassion.
Yeah.
I am struggling to have compassion for some people in my life.
Yeah.
And also looking out across the world at some, you know, quite popular, relevant people not doing the right thing. And do you feel that as well? And how do you cope with that?
There are certain people in the world whose behavior is very difficult to find compassion for. And especially if they're harming a lot of other people. There's a phrase in Tibetan Buddhism called idiot compassion. And there's another phrase going around now called suicidal empathy. So I'm wary of those kinds of things. And I don't demand of myself to have compassion in any full sense. But I can usually find understanding of how people are behaving and the stories in their heads, however deluded and egotistical and dangerous they might be. They're living with certain narratives that are making them behave the way they're behaving. And that's all I demand of myself. I sometimes don't feel compassion for certain types of people in certain types of behavior. I would add, though, I don't wish them harm. I often want them stopped, but I don't wish them harm.
So that experience of compassion that for the people that you may not approve of.
Yeah, use the word understanding.
Yeah. Is that an experience of something that comes through you? I'm just curious how you...
It comes through because I've made the experiment all kinds of ways. I've made the experience of being full of rage at certain things that I observed.
Yeah.
And feeling like hatred at times, long ago, but knowing that that is really a beast gnawing on itself. So I've made enough experiments with all these different types of emotions. So the ones that I can live with, I'm taking the easy way. My teacher, Poonjaji, used to always say, sometimes people say, you know, it's hard. This, what you're saying is a bit hard to come by, to experience. But I mean, he'd say, no, darling, I'm telling you the easy way. This is the easy way. It's just easier. Instead of fighting reality, and you always lose the battle when you fight reality, it's going to win. And are there people who are deluded and dangerous and mean and murderous? Yes, there are. And there have always been, apparently, if we believe history at all. Seems that, yeah, and even the fossil record shows that, turns out there was a lot of people were murdered back in prehistoric times. There was a lot of murder that went on. You didn't really know that until recently, until they've discovered a lot of that. So there's something kind of murderous running through the human species. And if you're going to just bang your head about that all the time, you're just going to be miserable. So can we come to understanding and say, okay, there is something, you know, there's some force in a human. Not all humans. You know, it's really interesting genetically. Our two closest relatives are chimps and bonobos. Chimps are very vicious. Bonobos are little sweethearts who just like to have sex all day. And those are our two closest genetic relatives. We're only like less than 2% different in genetics. We can feel both of them in us, and we can maybe feel more of one than the other, right? So if you just take that fact about human existence and about our genetic tendencies, and you extrapolate it to the whole world and to history as we see what behavior has been in history, and you have to just say, okay, gosh, you know, it's that way. And how am I going to deal with it? Well, my way is just understanding that, right? Just understanding that. And just like if you see National Geographic videos on anywhere on television or wherever you see them, and you see a lion running across the plains and taking down a zebra, it's painful, it's terrible, right? It's awful. You wish the zebra could be saved, but if that applied every single time, then the lion wouldn't be saved either. So you have a kind of understanding when you're watching something like that, as painful as it is, there is an understanding as to this is how it goes. Life feeds on life in different ways. And we see it writ large. Humans are much more complicated than that simple way of getting food. And humans have all kinds of behaviors that are mysteriously cruel. But it's just what's so. We even know in our own friends, I'm going to just go out on a limb here, we probably, because of our interest, as we can observe, you've come to this particular room for a Dharma immersion. Probably our tribe, our friends, aren't of the chimp persuasion, right? Yes, yes, it's a really lovely compliment. But we do know that each of them have certain peccadilloes, let's say. You know, our friends, we make allowances for this or that of their habits or their whatever, right? And then also for ourselves as well. It's just what's so. And we can easily have understanding for our friends when they might be selfish in a moment, or they're always late and leave you waiting in the rain, or whatever it is, you know, that we can understand, okay, right? That's the kind of so-called compassion. It's not, I'm making a distinction here in terms of people who are out there doing really terrible, terrible things. I don't force myself to feel compassion necessarily for them, unless I see them suffer. You know this series called The Tudors? Do you know that series? Really great. When it's about King Henry. It's an incredible series. Yeah. And I think several seasons, riveting. Well, he was pretty mean. He was fond of beheaded several of his wives and any enemy and sometimes friends that then became disloyal and so on. So there were a lot of beheadings. But along the way, also, there were some really bad guys who had done terrible things, torturers, you know. But then when you see them going up to the guillotine, you think, well, we don't have to go that far, you know. Like, they were really bad, and I really hated them before, but I didn't really want to see them beheaded. So that's what I'm saying, is that you can have just a kind of reasonable understanding for people's behavior. You can try to stop it as best you can. We can try to stop the cruelty in any way we can. Not that we have that many levers to do so, just in our own case, but
is what you've just said. Would you put that under the heading, the paradox?
Yeah.
You know, like my cat is the most affectionate, sweet cat, but the way she kills little animals is just
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So facets, we've got these facets.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we see what happens with people when they're pressed, like gentle people even, when they're pressed mm-hmm. too far, you can see what comes out, and it's just, it's innate in humans. Mm-hmm. Self-preservation. Mm-hmm. All the more reason to, in your own case, to choose this quiet, this presence, this contentment, this gratitude. And then you actually automatically feel connected to others. You just do. And you will be more gentle in your behavior and your relationships.
More understanding.
More understanding, yeah. Mm. Yeah. Much less demanding that they be other than they are, as long as they're not harming others, but that they're just living their lives as best they can. Yeah.
So to be around people that you've known for a long time, well, I'll say family members, a close family member, you know, and someone that I've felt that I could really just be and be myself with, whatever that self looked like. And she's my sister-in-law. And the other day I was with her, and for the first time ever, because we're Jewish and we were discussing Middle East, which is a dangerous topic at this time of life, and I was shocked because there was a real hot spot and something was said and she just went bright red, and I could actually feel her, she might have actually got up mm-hmm. and left. It was a real feeling of that, and we both recovered mm-hmm. but I haven't really recovered. Mm-hmm. I'm still holding that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, okay, what am I going to do with that?
Have you ever been on the other side of that, where you felt you needed to get up and get out?
Oh, many times. Mm-hmm. Many times. Mm-hmm. In fact, that was my preferred way of dealing with things, mm-hmm. was to just, you know.
Storm out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but you then understand the feeling.
Oh, yes. The wisdom of compassion.
Well, at least the understanding of the feeling of that need, right? You understand it since you've experienced it. Yeah. That's all really you need.
Nothing else to do.
No, just do you understand it? Mm. She had that kind of reaction that you yourself well know.
That I do, but what do I do with the bit that's so contrary to our humanity? In other words, very different
ideas
about what's going on.
But she may see that her view is the appropriate or the truthful view, right? So, okay, there's an impasse, and because perhaps neither of you are going to be able to solve the Middle East problem.
not anytime soon.
It has been tried a few times, as we all know. Maybe that's a subject you avoid.
Very wise. Thank you.
And that's fair. And again, we're loaded with all kinds of concepts and spiritual concepts and psychological and, you know, new age therapy concepts about how we have to get it all out and speak our mind and da-da-da, and that's the... Not necessarily. The Buddha said, speak the truth, but only the truth that's useful.
Oh, that's my medicine. Thank you very much.
Yeah. And there's a lot of things that can go unsaid, and we can all be a lot more happy in the situation, right? Things can go unsaid. And I'm not recommending hiding yourself or lying or dissembling or any of that. You've now both made clear where you stand. Maybe that's enough said. And then you return to that which is the connection.
Thank you so much for that.
You're so welcome.
That's really good.
Complete happenstance has me here today.
Oh.
I was writing a message to someone and I said it was a vortex of serendipity. I am very appreciative of sitting and taking it in. There's a lot here that I probably will go away and ruminate on.
Mm.
I found it really interesting, the contentment thing, and I'm sort of playing with the concepts in the room about there is a path, or at least a perception of a path through life. Contentment, as I interpret it,
mm-hmm.
places me in a space, but somewhat directionless.
Mm.
So I'm interested in the concept, I guess, of manifestation in terms of presence and being and how that might actually manifest a path forward.
What I often say is that doing flows from being most beautifully. When you're sitting in that center and you're relaxed and you're content even, it opens space for creativity. Things come through. Your own genius and talent is uninhibited in that regard because you're relaxed. You're not using up a whole bunch of your attention and your awareness on the me project, right? The rumination about me and how am I doing and how do I appear? What do they think of me? Am I producing enough? Am I manifesting enough? You just get out of your own way and then you have energy. And that will manifest itself in the most appropriate ways for you in your life. Now, that might be that you don't have any big projects, right? Who knows what comes when one is sitting in your own self? It doesn't have to look like anything that one thinks it should look like, you know?
Are you comfortable being held accountable for me selling everything this afternoon?
Yeah, I've had times when it all just went. I have had times, but I do like having a home, I have to admit. Getting too old for the sadhu days. I played them out.
I've actually come down a mountain. I've been up in the Andes for the last 10 years
Wow. In
Peru, and I'm back because my mum is very sick.
Okay.
And I feel very accepting of her journey, and my dad is still around and he's supporting her as much as he can. But I guess my question really is about death and supporting them mm-hmm. as gracefully as I can mm-hmm. when she's so grumpy and so unhappy and in pain and my dad's so stressed, and I've tried to give suggestions and they're not very welcome, and I'm trying my best to be as graceful through the process. But yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, if that's not too much.
I'm going to borrow, and I have said it in this room before, one of my closest friends did a hospice training many, many years ago, and her hospice teacher said, all you need to do is be a non-anxious presence. A non-anxious presence. You don't have to have the wise words. You don't have to react. You don't have to do anything. You just keep being a non-anxious presence. You don't bring your anxiety or your resistance. You're a sanctuary, you're a safe space where everybody can just chill around, whether it's your dad or whoever's visiting or your mother. And people, when they're at the end, some people get very agitated, very grumpy, they're scared, they're in pain. We can only have compassion for that and understanding and just do your best. You don't have to be heroic, but do your best if you can. And yeah, keep it simple. You don't have to have any big, important conversations unless it feels okay to do so. Right? Sometimes people, when they're dying, they don't want to have these big, intense conversations, you know. They don't want to. One of my friends, his dad, it was a huge industrialist in America and had always just been kind of tromping around Earth, having his way. And my friend, his son, was a very dharmic guy. And anyway, his father was dying in the hospital, right? And he was in such heavy denial that on the very day he died, he had demanded that his nurses take him down to physical therapy downstairs. And they just kept saying, you can't do physical therapy today. But he was very, like, insistent, but they didn't take him because they could hardly get him out of the bed. But he had this idea. Anyway, my friend, his son, goes to see him on these last days. And on one of those last days, says to him, Dad, I just want to tell you how grateful I've been for you and all that I've learned for you. And his father said, I don't want to hear this stuff. Like, don't do that. So he didn't. He just got quiet. And to each his own, right? You often relive as we die. Yeah. This has been In the Deep. If you'd like to support these podcasts, please visit katherineingram.com, where you can make a donation, tax deductible in the United States, and where you can book a private session or join our mailing list to be informed of upcoming events. We would also appreciate a review on any platform of your choice. Till next time.